Letters, we don't write them as much anymore, which makes you wonder about what's getting lost to history. But thanks to a new collection of letters by the famous and not so famous, we have another glorious reminder of just how valuable they can be. Today we'll talk about letters from John Lennon to Eric Clapton to join his band, and a hungover Jane Austen's report on a ball she attended, and other misses from Winston Churchill and Richard Burton. With us today is Sean Usher, whose latest compilation is Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Sean is also the author of Lists of Note, which brought him to our show last year. He joins us this morning via Skype from Manchester, England. Sean, welcome back. So good to have you.
Oh, sir, the pleasure's all mine.
Where did you come up with these letters, Sean?
Well, that's a very good question. So I started the website back in 2009, and since then it's been visited by, I think it's 120 million people, which means I get suggestions from a lot of people, which makes my life a lot easier. I've kind of built up a network of archivists and museum curators around the world over the years. So I'm regularly, you know, in touch with these people, asking whether they found anything new. They get in touch with me when they find some gems. I buy, you know, letters used to make up the majority of biographies. So I buy a lot of old biographies of interesting people. Hmm. And I'm always searching for letters within those kind of books. So they come from all angles. The difficult part these days, because I have less time because of the success of these books, the difficult part is kind of sifting through all these amazing letters to kind of to find the best. But, you know, what a great problem to have.
Are there some letters you know about but you can't get your hands on, Sean?
there are so many. What's more frustrating is having a letter in my possession but not being able to use it, because I need to get permission to use these letters in the books and on the stage. So the most frustrating thing for me, there's one letter in particular that I always mention when someone says this to me, and it's a letter written by Stephen King. Before he became famous, I think he was 19 years old, and there was a snowstorm, a very big snowstorm in his town, and he wrote this letter to his friend in which he described the snowstorm in a way that only Stephen King could, and it's the most chilling, beautiful, evocative description of a snowstorm, but I just cannot get permission to use it. So it burns a hole in my pocket every single day.
Why do you need permission from him to run the letter?
Because it's his copyright, you know. Even with a letter, but particularly a private letter, I just need permission from the person that wrote it. If they've died, then I need permission from their estate. If the letter's it varies country to country, but generally, if the letter's over, say 60, 65 years old, then I'm free to use it without permission. But it's always best to, you know, always err on the side of caution and get permission anyway. Yeah. It's the bane of my life, to be honest. But it's worth the effort.
Well, let's go to some of these letters, you know, so many of which are fascinating. We'll begin with John Lennon's letter to Eric Clapton. I just love this thing. This is about 1969, and John Lennon, the Beatles have ended here, and Lennon wants the great Clapton to join his band. Luke Martin from KCUR's up-to-date staff is going to read a portion of John Lennon's letter here.
Dear Eric, I've been meaning to write or call you for a few weeks now. I think maybe writing will give you and yours more time to think. You must know by now that Yoko and I rate your music and yourself very highly, always have. You also know the kind of music we've been making and hope to make. Anyway, the point is, after missing the Bangladesh concert, we began to feel more and more like going on the road. But not the way I used to with the Beatles, night after night of torture. We've asked Klaus Jim Keltner, Nicky Hopkins, Phil Spector even, to form a nucleus group, Plastic Ono Band, and between us all would decide what, if any, augmentation to the group we'd like, that is, Sax's vocal group. They all agreed so far, and of course we had you in mind as soon as we had decided. We've long admired your music and always kept an eye open to see what you're up to of late lately. Eric, I know I can bring out something great, in fact greater in you, that has been so far and evident in your music. I hope to bring out the same kind of greatness in all of us, which I know will happen if, when we get together. I'm not trying to pressure you in any way, and would quite understand if you decide against joining us. We would still love and respect you. We're not asking you for your name. I'm sure you know this. It's your mind we want. Anyway, there it is. If you want to talk more, please call us or even come over here to New York. Or write. At least think about it. Please don't be frightened. I understand paranoia only too well. I think it could only do good for you to work with people who love and respect you, and that's from all of us. Lots of love to you both from John and Yoko.
That's a letter to Eric Clapton from John Lennon asking Clapton to join the band. And Sean, I guess it goes without saying that that reunion of John Lennon and Eric Clapton never took place.
Well, he did. He did actually. He did join the band, but very temporarily.
I was going to. Okay, must have been very temporarily then. Yeah.
It was very temporary. Yeah, I don't think he played with them that often, but it did work. You know, in a sense, I don't know whether it was that particular letter, but I mean, that's like an 8-page letter. It's a really long, handwritten letter. I love the fact that you can. It's such an interesting moment in musical history. What I also love about John Lennon and Yoko Ono, whenever they wrote letters, or you know, the majority of the time that they wrote letters, they both signed them. So on a lot of Yoko Ono's letters, you'll see her sign at the bottom, and then often it says underneath it in John Lennon's handwriting, it says P.S. I agree, John Lennon. And I just love the fact that they kind of co-signed all their letters. But yeah, fantastic letter.
It was interesting later in that missive, John Lennon's asking Clapton or proposing the idea of going island hopping out in the Pacific Ocean. They want to take their time, maybe record some stuff. He had this grand vision of how they would spend their time together.
I know, what a life. You know, yes. imagine you had the resources and time to even consider that sort of thing seriously. But yeah, it's, I mean, two giants of the music world. It just makes, I often imagine all the letters that I haven't seen, you know. Mm-hmm. I imagine how many letters between greats like this you just never will see. And it's pretty frustrating.
Another Beatle, George Harrison, received a letter from his friend Spike Milligan, who used his comedic talent to admonish the musician for a lack of communication. First, let's hear actor Andrew Scott's reading of this letter.
6th of December, 1983. Dear George, you once said to us, the world is full of arseholes, and I am not one of them. I have a love for certain people, and I have one for you, but by sheer lack of contact, it's running out. I phone you frequently and never get a reply. This is what you do. It's very simple. You stand in front of a telephone and you insert your fingers in the holes and carry out a series of numbers which have been given to you. Of course, if you are rich, you have two buttons, which Irishmen usually sew on their coats. Of course, if you are extremely rich, you don't have to get in touch with anybody, and that's what I am worried about. The funeral takes place at Golders Green Crematorium. No flowers, please. Just money. You'll recognize me. I'm the dead one. Love, light, and peace. Spike Milligan.
So Spike was frustrated that George Harrison wasn't responding to his letters, I gather, Sean?
Yeah, he was. George Harrison was notoriously terrible at getting back to people, either by phone or by letter. And Spike Milligan. I could have released a book of just Spike Milligan's letters. He was a prolific letter writer, and I can just imagine him writing to George, you know, every day and just not getting a response. He was just, you can feel his frustration through the letter. He was a fantastic letter writer, Spike Milligan. But I've seen, unsurprisingly, I found very few letters from George Harrison to anyone.
Hmm. We're visiting with Sean Usher, who's put together his latest book, Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. We just had Candace Millard on our program last week, Sean, for her new book, Hero of the Republic, about Winston Churchill's daring escape from a prison in South Africa back in 1899. Amazon just named it the year's best history book. Let's look at a letter that Churchill wrote that he left beneath his pillow before he escaped. KCUR's Coy Duggar is going to read a little bit from this letter from Winston Churchill.
Dear Mr. De Souza, I do not consider that your government was justified in holding me, a press correspondent and a non-combatant, as a prisoner, and I have consequently resolved to escape. My views on the general question of the war remain unchanged, but I shall always retain a feeling of high respect for the several classes of the burghers I have met, and, on reaching the British lines, I will set forth a truthful and impartial account of my experiences in Pretoria. In conclusion, I desire to express my obligations to you, and to hope that when this most grievous and unhappy war shall come to an end, a state of affairs may be created which shall preserve at once the national pride of the Boer and the security of the British, and put a final stop to the rivalry and enmity of both races. Regretting the circumstances have not permitted me to bid you a personal farewell. Believe me, yours sincerely, Winston S. Churchill.
Coy, that was very good. And that sounds like exactly the tone that Winston Churchill would have been using at that time, Sean.
I know. This is 40 years before he was prime minister. Yes. It must be the most polite, you know, notice of escape that's ever been written. I just love it to death. But also, I love the fact that on the envelope he wrote PPC, which stands for I'm going to try and pronounce this, pour prendre congé, which means to take leave. I mean, even the envelope was really polite. You know, I love that letter.
Well, Candace in her book points out just how self-confident Winston Churchill was back then, and that comes through in this letter as well. Just the fact he wrote the letter to begin with, I think. So,
exactly. Yeah.
Let's move on here to another one who faced great challenges in life. And this was Helen Keller. Both blind and deaf, she was the subject of the famous play and movie The Miracle Worker and became an inspiration to people around the world. Her letter was something totally unexpected. It's about a musical experience. Let's listen to a bit of Gillian Anderson reading Helen Keller's letter.
February 2nd, 1924. The New York Symphony Orchestra, New York City. Dear friends, I have the joy of being able to tell you that, though deaf and blind, I spent a glorious hour last night listening over the radio to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I do not mean to say that I heard the music in the sense that other people heard it, and I do not know whether I can make you understand how it was possible for me to derive pleasure from the symphony. It was a great surprise to myself. I had been reading in my magazine for the blind of the happiness that the radio was bringing to the sightless everywhere. I was delighted to know that the blind had gained a new source of enjoyment, but I did not dream that I could have any part of their joy. Last night, when my family was listening to your wonderful rendering of the Immortal Symphony, someone suggested that I put my hand on the receiver and see if I could get any of the vibrations. He unscrewed the cap, and I lightly touched the sensitive diaphragm. What was my amazement to discover that I could feel not only the vibrations, but also the impassioned rhythm, the throb and the urge of the music, the intertwined and intermingling vibrations from different instruments enchanted me. I could actually distinguish the cornets, the roll of the drums, deep-toned violas and violins singing in exquisite unison. How the lovely speech of the violins flowed and plowed over the deepest tones of the other instruments. When the human voice leapt up, trilling from the surge of harmony, I recognized them instantly as voices. I felt the chorus grow more exultant, more ecstatic, upcurving, swift, and flame-like, until my heart almost stood still.
That's Helen Keller listening, with quotes around the word listening, to the symphony. You know, she was a prolific writer during her lifetime, Sean. How were you able to find this particular single letter?
This letter, that's a very good question. I found it because it was printed, it was so beautifully written, and it was so well received by the orchestra that it was printed in the newspaper. I think it was a few days later.
Wow!
And I was looking for a separate letter by Helen Keller. In fact, she wrote another letter about going to the top of the Empire State Building, and she described in similar detail the most beautiful description of the view, even though she couldn't see in the traditional sense, of the view from the top of the Empire State Building. And I was looking for something about that letter, and I found this letter, and it was just the most incredible moment. You know, it's like a natural high, yes. Finding these letters. But she was the most amazing, as you can see, I mean, she was the most amazing letter writer. And it's almost, you know, it's like you hear about, you know, deaf, blind people having their other senses heightened. It was almost as if, I don't know, she was just, she writes like no other person, despite the fact that she can't actually, you know, enjoy these views and these experiences the same way we can. But my goodness, it puts us to shame. It puts me to shame anyway.
Well, she describes so eloquently listening to the symphony by touching the diaphragm of the radio receiver. How was she able to describe the view from atop the Empire State Building?
Well, she spoke about, you know, touching the architecture, actually, you know, touching the building and hearing other people talk about the view and the wind from the top. And she just had such a just an incredible way of interpreting different feelings, you know, and kind of channeling them in some incredible way. But it never the way she writes, it never kind of sounds as if she's, you know, just doing it for effect, if you know what I mean. It just sounds very, very natural. Just an amazing lady.
Let's turn to another prominent woman of letters here, Jane Austen, who you point out wrote terrific letters, although many wound up being destroyed by her sister. And you always sink a little bit when you read something like that, at least I do. You know, in this letter from 1800, Jane Austen admits that she drank a bit too much the night before. KCUR's Danny Alexander is going to read a little bit from Jane Austen's letter here.
Steventon, Thursday, November 20th, 1800. My dear Cassandra, your letter took me quite by surprise this morning. You are very welcome, however, and I'm very much obliged to you. I believe I drank too much wine last night at Hurstbourne. I know not how else to account for the shaking of my hand today. You will kindly make allowance, therefore, for any indistinctness of writing by attributing it to this venial error. Your desiring to hear from me on Sunday will perhaps bring you a more particular account of the ball than you may care for, because one is prone to think much more of such things the morning after they happen than when time has entirely driven them out of one's recollection. There were only 12 dances, of which I danced 9, and was merely prevented from dancing the rest by the want of a partner. We began at 10, supped at 1, and were at Dean before 5. There were but 50 people in the room, very few families indeed from our side of the county, and not many more from the other. There were very few beauties, and such as there were not very handsome. Miss Ironmonger did not look well, and Mrs. Blunt was the only one much admired. She appeared exactly as she did in September, with the same broad face, diamond bandeau, white shoes, pink husband, and fat neck. The two Miss Coxes were there. I traced in one the remains of the vulgar, broad-featured girl who danced at Enham 8 years ago. The other is refined into a nice, composed-looking girl like Catherine Bigg. I looked at Sir Thomas Champneys and thought of poor Rosalie. I looked at his daughter and thought her a queer animal with a white neck. Mrs. Warren, I was constrained to think, a very fine young woman, which I much regret. She has got rid of some part of her child and danced away with great activity, looking by no means very large. Her husband is ugly enough, uglier even than his cousin John, but he does not look so very old. The Miss Maitlands were both prettyish, very like Anne, with brown skins, large dark eyes, and a good deal of nose. The general has got the gout, and Mrs. Maitland the jaundice. Miss Debbery, Susan, and Sally, all in black, but without any stature, made their appearance, and I was as civil to them as their bad breath would allow me. Farewell. Charles sends you his best love and Edward his worst. If you think the distinction improper, you may take the worst yourself. He will write to you when he gets back to his ship, and in the meantime desires that you will consider me as your affectionate sister, J.A.
Oh, that's great. And none of that surprises me coming from Jane Austen, Sean.
No, she takes no prisoners. It makes me really sad to think of all the letters that were destroyed, you know, because I can imagine she was like that all the time. And, it's painful to think of the things we're missing.
I guess
she's fantastic. I mean,
they didn't have mouthwash back then, did they?
Apparently not. No. Yeah. I love the way she describes someone as having a good deal of nose.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. A turn of phrase is unrivaled.
I'm wondering how caught up do you get in some of these people's lives while you're researching for the collections that you put together here?
I become obsessed with different people most days. I mean, this is my full-time job. Somehow, I don't know how it's happened, this has become my full-time job. So I spend my days just kind of, you know, diving down little holes and just becoming completely obsessed with these people and their families. And well, a good thing is, because I have to get permission to use these letters, it means that I find myself getting in touch with the families of people that are loosely connected to the letters. So I in some way, you know, become not friends, but I'm in contact with people that are kind of alive in these letters. And it's a fantastic feeling. But I, you know, it had it not become popular, I would still be doing it, because I just, you know, I can't stop. It's a passion.
Well, that's Sean Usher, whose latest compilation is titled Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. And Sean, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
I should point out that Sean joined us via Skype from Manchester, England. It's time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the history of UMKC. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, our Johnson County librarian friends brought us their top reads for kids of all ages. Check out their list at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, The Geography of Genius looks at how creativity flourishes by being in the right place at the right time. Also, we pause for remembrance in honor of the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Well, what's been around for more than 80 years is still sometimes overlooked in Kansas City, but has produced more than 47,000 people working in the city. That's the University of Missouri, Kansas City, which today has 115,000 alumni around the globe. The idea of a university in this town was intensely debated, and founders would have been thrilled with 125 students in its first year of 1933. But they ended up far topping that, and today enrollment reaches more than 16,000 people. Christopher Wolfe has put together a new history of the school in his book, A Pearl of Great Value, The History of UMKC, Kansas City's University. He manages the UMKC bookstore, and just a reminder to our listeners, I teach journalism over on campus. And Chris, welcome. So good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you got started on this project by researching something called Hobo Day, which you write was one of the university's most beloved traditions. What was Hobo Day?
Well, it goes back to the original year of the university. In the spring of 1934, there was a student protest against the firing of some professors.
Yes.
And the following year, the students came to memorialize this strike, and they were dressed as hobos, and they put on skits that lampooned the administration. Well, this turned into a yearly event called Hobo Day.
And a lot to lampoon, probably, now, yeah.
And they would have skits and pie-eating contest, tug-of-war over the campus pond. There was a faculty versus student baseball game. And then at the evening, there would be a formal dance called the Kangaroo Hop, where a beauty contest was held and the Kangaroo Queen was honored. And this was a beloved holiday and lasted at the university all the way through 1980.
Wow. And then it disappeared. Oh, it's too bad. We should bring it back.
Yeah, well, we can't bring it back. Something like that has to be student-driven.
Yeah.
The students have to bring that back.
There were other colleges already up and running in Kansas City back in the 1920s, Chris. Why did some leaders think the city needed yet another university back then?
Well, they wanted something that was going to be a comprehensive university that in time would incorporate professional schools. What we had at that time were some small private schools like Park College and Rockhurst College, and they never had the aim or the scope to be more comprehensive universities that could have a more broad education that would include professional education like law, dentistry, et cetera.
Yeah, I was really struck by the fact that even up until its opening in 1933, some city residents were still questioning the need for it.
Yeah, that's correct, because most people who could afford to send their children to college automatically sent them to MU or KU.
Mm-hmm.
But the founders of this university wanted to have a university that was an option for those students in Kansas City that couldn't afford to go elsewhere. They wanted this to truly be Kansas City's university.
Now, I've heard you say that you have some hope that a book like this can add some some cohesion, I guess might be the word, and maybe some spirit to a campus that is still largely a commuter campus.
This is true. That was one of my kind of reasons for writing the book. I've worked at UMKC for over 10 years now, and I love the community at UMKC, but I've always been struck that people know so little about its history.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also been struck at, you know, the lack of, you know, school spirit, so to speak, at the university that you would see like at MU or KU or a school like that. And I figured, you know, if I could contribute to creating a spirit like that with informing everybody of their common history, you know, that's something I'd like to accomplish.
You know, the first idea for a campus here involved an institution named after, I didn't know this, Abraham Lincoln and Robert E. Lee. What was all that about?
So, yeah, the first incarnation of the university was going to be in conjunction with the Methodist Church, which back in those days had been split into northern and southern factions. And the two factions were looking for a way to reunite the church. And so collaborating on a university project in Kansas City was seen as a first step towards that reunification. And it was going to be called Lincoln and Lee University, of course, to honor Abraham Lincoln and Robert E. Lee. But it would also help heal the divisions in the church and in the Kansas City community as well. You know, this was the 1920s, so there's still, you know, actual memories about the Civil War in this area. And we got a donation of land at 75th and State Line for the campus. So some of the land would be on the Missouri side, some of the land would be on the Kansas side. So it was going to be the perfect location for the theme of this university.
What happened?
They were never able to raise the money for the university. And they had involved many civic leaders in Kansas City, and they made an effort to invite Catholics and Jews and other Protestant denominations to be on the board. And they also had invited the Kansas City Chamber of Commerce to be part of the movement. And the Chamber of Commerce became disillusioned when they couldn't raise enough money, and they never really liked the idea of a sectarian university in the first place. And they didn't like the campus being at 75th and State Line, which in the 1920s was on the edge of town.
Huh.
So they decided to break off and form their own university called the University of Kansas City.
And that's what it became today.
And that's what it became today.
Yeah. You know, key to all this, and this really struck me, the name that pops up over and over again, at least in those first set of early years here, was a guy named William Volcker. Who was he, and Chris, what did he do to make Kansas City's university come to be? Because he did a whole lot.
He is really an unsung hero. Absolutely. Of Kansas City history. He was a German immigrant, had moved to Chicago when he was 9 years old, didn't speak a word of English. He moved to Kansas City and started up a business selling wholesale home furnishings, which was a new idea in those days in the late 1800s. Back then, if you wanted lampshades, you had to go to the lampshade manufacturer. If you wanted curtain rods, you had to go to the curtain rod manufacturer. There was no place where you could buy all home furnishings in one spot. So he created a wholesale distribution of home furnishings and quickly made a huge fortune. And early on, he decided he was going to set aside $1 million to take care of himself and his family, and the rest of the money he'd give away to the people of Kansas City. And one of his biggest projects was the University of Kansas City.
Hmm. And over and over again, he was the guy people turned to when money was needed for at a very key moment in the university's early years.
That's correct. Much like the Lincoln and Lee University movement, the trustees of the University of Kansas City were not able to raise enough money on their own to create the university. And in the heart of the Depression in 1933, they came to a crossroads. They didn't know, should we go forward or should we stop? And they went to Mr. Volcker and said, Mr. Volcker, we don't know if we're going to be able to continue. And he told them, go ahead and open the university and I'll help you with operating costs. So even though they didn't raise the amount of money they needed, they went ahead and opened.
You could almost make a case that the school could be named Volcker University. I mean, he was that central to what happened here.
That's true, but it was very against his personality. In fact, his nickname was Mr. Anonymous. He preferred to give all of his money anonymously.
Isn't there a book, a biography of him that's titled Mr. Anonymous?
That's correct. That's the name of his biography.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. He was such an amazing man. You could go to his office at William Volcker and Company. It's still down by the building's still down by the city market. You could go meet with him and say, Mr. Volcker, I've fallen on hard times. Can you help me out? And he would write you a check out of his personal checking account.
No kidding.
Yeah.
But too bad he's gone. I'd go see him. Yeah. I'd go see him tomorrow. Yeah. Where's his old office down there?
It's right across from the City Market.
No kidding.
Yeah, and you can still see it says William Volker and Company on the side of the building.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Chris Wolf, who's the author of a new history of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It's titled A Pearl of Great Value, The History of UMKC, Kansas City's University. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR. Up to date. You know, a feud involving the Kansas City Star and a man named Walter S. Dickey also proved pivotal here early on to the campus becoming what it is today. What was that fight all about? Because it was nasty.
So Walter Dickey was an industrialist. His business was making baked clay sewer pipes. And well, back in the days before that plastic, that's what you use for conduit and for sewer pipes and water pipes was baked clay. And he built a huge mansion at 51st and Holmes, or 51st and Rock Hill, which is today known as Schofield Hall at the university. And he had been a friend with Nelson. And
William Rock Hill Nelson,
William Rock Hill
publisher
Nelson,
of the Star.
Publisher of the Star. And the two got in an argument over politics in 1912 and never spoke again. And Nelson would go on to pass away in 1915. And in his will, he stated that he wanted his home torn down and an art museum built in its place. And Dickey kind of, forgot about Nelson. And he was active in local politics. And during an election in 1922, the Kansas City Star published a disparaging article about him. And so he had this lingering, anger towards Nelson that he now turned towards the Star itself. Hmm. And so he bought the Kansas City Journal and the Kansas City Post, which were the Star's competitors. And during the decade of the 20s, invested his entire fortune trying to put the Star out of business. Well, what happened was he went bankrupt and he had to mortgage his home and his 10-acre estate for $75,000, which was less than 10% of its value.
Wow.
And then when he passed away in 1930, William Volker was able to buy the house and the 10-acre property for $75,000, and it became the heart of the Volker campus.
I was going to say, today it's the home of the College of Arts and Sciences.
That's correct.
And other things as well.
Yeah. If that had not happened, if Dickey had kept his money, we would never have been able to afford to buy his house and property, and the university might not exist today.
The university opened in October of 1933, and the early hope was for 125 students. The thinking was if the new school could attract 125, it could ultimately survive. But how many wound up being in that first class, Chris?
They had to cut it off at 266 students because they felt that the Dickey Mansion couldn't possibly hold any more students than that.
You've already referred to this, but when spring came, trouble broke out. And why were the students so upset?
Well, the trustees of the university fired a couple of professors without any due process.
And these were popular professors.
They were popular professors, and the students were outraged that there was no due process or any reason given other than they just were fired.
Yeah.
And this time, the university didn't have a president. The secretary of the Board of Trustees, a man named Ernest Newcomb, was also the administrator of the university. But he was never named president or given the powers of president. And so this strike brought national attention to the university and was one of the reasons the university decided to go with a president.
Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about the history of UMKC. Karen from Roland Park. Karen, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. I graduated from UMKC in 1964, and unless I'm mistaken, that was the first year that it was UMKC. Prior to that, I believe it was a private college called Kansas City University.
When did that switch take place, Chris?
Yes, that was in 1963. And the reason that the university merged with the University of Missouri system was that it had fallen on very hard financial times. After Mr. Volker passed away in 1947, they had a difficult time raising funds each year to cover operating costs. And they never had that opportunity at the very beginning to raise a huge endowment to carry them through tough times. And so each year they had to raise enough money to cover that year's expenses. And by the early 1960s, they were falling into huge deficits. And so they had no choice but to merge with the University of Missouri system.
Well, Karen, that makes you a pioneer,
well,
I guess.
You know, the the thing that I find amusing is I never went to UMKC. I went to Kansas City University. I finished in the summer, and they didn't have a summer graduation. So my diploma says UMKC, even though I never attended UMKC.
I won't tell anybody, Karen. I'm glad to know it. Thank you for calling.
Bye.
Yeah, in fact, the University of Missouri contacted all of the previous graduates of the University of Kansas City and told them they could get a UMKC diploma if they wanted.
And did a lot of kids do that?
I don't know what the numbers are, but I'm assuming some did.
Well, there were some interesting rules back in the early days, Chris. Boys had to wear blue and gold beanies, and girls had to wear blue and gold ribbons in their hair. What happened if they didn't follow those rules?
Well, the girls would get a fine, and they would have a restriction from social events or, you know, things like that.
The boys,
you could get the belt from the sophomore enforcement crew, or you might take a dunk in the campus pond. And that was very common in those days. Freshman hazing was not only accepted at universities, but it was part of the official policy of the universities because it had always gone on for hundreds of years.
Okay, the big question, the question that a lot of people probably still wonder to this day, why is the kangaroo the official mascot of UMKC? And I know the students voted it in, but still it always struck me as a little bit unusual here.
Well, the University of Kansas City always went by the initials KCU, much like University of Kansas goes by KU.
And therefore, the call letters for this radio station, KCUR.
That's correct. That's why it's KCUR, not UKCR.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1936, the university's debate team was getting ready to compete against another university. And so the students decided, well, we need to have a mascot. And someone came up with the idea of, why not the kangaroos? We could be the KCU kangaroos. And at that time, the Swope Park Zoo was getting in an exhibit of baby kangaroos, and it had been in the news. And so it was very timely, and people thought it was cute. But half the students didn't think that was dignified enough, and so they didn't like the idea of the KCU kangaroos. But the students who did like the idea formed a student political party and ran for student government and won in the spring of 1937. And their platform was making the kangaroo the mascot.
That's what they were going to stand for, by George.
Yeah. And then at that same time, some students started up a humor magazine called The Kangaroo. It was published on campus, and it had like campus anecdotes and cartoons and things like that. And one of the creators of the magazine knew Walt Disney from his days here in Kansas City and wrote him a letter and said, hey, would you draw a cover for our magazine? And so Disney drew the first depiction of KC Kangaroo, which we, of course, as the university, still use today.
UMKC's first black student was a man named Harold Holliday. How controversial was his admission back, I think, in the 1950s?
No, this would have been 1948.
1948, yeah.
It was very controversial because Kansas City at that time was very much a southern city. And the university had considered admitting black students before, but they were very nervous what the public's reaction would be. But after the war, we had a number of black veterans come to the university to our Veterans Advisement Center. And one of those veterans, Harold Holliday, applied for our law school, and he was denied admission. Well, he talked to his fellow veterans that were attending at the university, and they were on his side, and they started writing letters to the trustees and to the president urging his acceptance. And then the faculty of the university had a resolution to also admit him as well. And so there was a lot of pressure on the trustees and the president to admit him, and they finally decided they would go ahead, and they were nervous. And so the Kansas City Star agreed not to publish anything about this for 1 year.
That just floored me. I saw that in a little side note you had in the book. The Star agreed not to report this for an entire year.
Yeah.
That's so unlike newspapers and sort of what we stand for.
Yeah. Well, Henry Haskell, the publisher of the Star, was on the board of trustees at the time, because they were nervous about the public's reaction. But what they found was that the students were totally accepting of him. And, the president of the university got a couple of nasty letters. But beyond that, there was none of the backlash what they had expected. They were thinking, you know, that there was going to be a riot.
Mm-hmm. You've already mentioned what happened in 1963 when the University of Kansas City merged with the University of Missouri. This also was intensely controversial. I'm wondering why.
Well, this university is Kansas City's university. So by joining the University of Missouri system, we are taking the authority for the university out of Kansas Cityans' hands and giving it to the Board of Curators.
Losing some autonomy.
Losing autonomy. Mm-hmm. And it was a very rough transition for the first 6 or 7 years before really we were fully incorporated into the system and everybody was
new
accepting
people to
the
report
roles.
To, new financial systems and everything else, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, there was people on that had never had to ask for permission before, and now they had to get permission from 5 different people. And so it was a rough transition at first.
Is that the most significant moment in the university's history, Chris?
I believe so, because I believe the university would have gone bankrupt if it had not merged with the University of Missouri system.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the fears that the university had of losing autonomy were more than compensated for by the fact that the state was able to give us the resources we need to reach our full potential.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, ultimately it proved that this was the right decision to merge.
You know, every campus, it seems like, has a haunted house, or at least it seems like it. UMKC's haunted house is Epperson House, and man, it looks like a haunted house.
It does look like a haunted house. It's a very controversial and touchy subject on campus. You know, the university doesn't like to promote Epperson House as being possibly haunted because
then kids would want to hang in there.
Well, yeah, and it has a huge problem of people trying to break into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the police blotter and the campus newspaper every week, there's someone who's arrested trying to break into Epperson House because it has this reputation of being haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it's empty, and so it's difficult to protect.
But why is it empty? Because it's a beautiful, astonishingly beautiful house.
It is very beautiful. The woodwork inside is unbelievable.
I would love to see it sometime. Yeah.
But it is not ADA compliant, and it's got a very strange organization inside. You can't walk 10 feet in any direction without going up or down a few stairs. And so to make it ADA compliant, you'd have to put in ramps and elevators, and the estimated cost for that is going to be about $10 million. And
wow.
So right now the university doesn't have that kind of money to spend on the project, and also we don't have a program that wants to move in there.
Okay. Back to some phone calls here. Ruth Ann from Kansas City, Missouri. Ruth Ann, good morning.
Good morning. That pool you talked about was just a little natural pool fed by natural spring water. And it was about 40 by 60 feet and not terribly deep. You could be thrown into it, as I was in the fall of 44, for not having my beanie on.
See, you're living proof of one of those kids, eh? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was very fun. It was very nice. And I loved it before it became the interstate or whatever it is now. I liked it more private.
Well, what was campus life like back in those days, Ruth Ann?
You could put your books down anywhere and nobody would bother them until you picked them up again.
Mm. Yeah.
It was a lovely, lovely place.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Those are great memories. And that pool, that pond is no longer there, Chris.
It's no longer there. It was a beloved feature of the campus for many years. And it's the spot where the stone for Dickey's Mansion was originally quarried. And so it filled up with rainwater, and there was a natural spring there. There was a flock of wild ducks that lived there. There was a bevy of wild quail that lived there. And there was a little piece of nature on the campus that was cherished.
What happened to it then?
Well, every year they used to empty it out, clean all the weeds and trash out of it, and the fire department would come and fill it back up with water. But in the late 60s, the biology department wanted to use it as a living laboratory. And so they stopped cleaning it out and they let it go wild. Well, it quickly became overgrown and like a malarial swamp. So the campus knew that was going to be a prime building location, so they went ahead and started to try to drain it. But it would fill back up again, so they tried to drain it again, and it went on for a while until they finally built Florsheim Hall in 1999 and were able to divert the natural spring to the stormwater sewer.
Huh. You know, I've had this sense, Chris, that broadly speaking, UMKC has come of age in a sense in recent years. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, it was often overlooked. Today, it seems to have more of a presence. Am I seeing that right?
I believe so. Just like in my own experience, my youngest daughter goes to Shawnee Mission North over in Johnson County, and she wants to come to UMKC. Many of her friends have chosen to come to UMKC. However, my older daughter, who is only 4 years older, when she was in high school, none of her friends had even heard of UMKC. And so I believe that our reputation is growing, and it helps having the metro rate so that Kansas students pay the same rate as Missouri students. But I believe our reputation is growing, and a lot of our programs, are gaining not only regional notoriety but national notoriety. And I think that our reputation continues to grow.
And so the future for the campus, just in the 30 seconds I have left, is what?
I believe our best days are ahead of us. I think that some of the programs we have going on, like the Enterprise Center and the Downtown Arts Campus, are really going to take the university to new heights, and will really make us a nationally recognized and cherished university.
That's Christopher Wolfe. He's put together a new history of UMKC. It's titled A Pearl of Great Value, The History of UMKC, Kansas City's University. Chris, great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/up to date. Tomorrow, the area is where genius is born, and a moment of remembrance for Pearl Harbor's 75th anniversary. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.